It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Centrists and those in the media have long presented the white nationalist movement as simply the home of poor and uneducated people. But in reality, there's a long and at times revolutionary history to white nationalism that deserves serious analysis and reflection. In the 1980s and 1990s, the white nationalist movement operated out of a variety of Christian identity camps and Bible study retreats. They opened radio stations and organized heavily armed homesteads that carried out paramilitary training. As anarchists and autonomists, we give a lot of lip service to the idea of living and fighting and building dual power. But in this period, neo-Nazis and white supremacists were putting those ideas into practice as the corpses piled up and the bombs began to explode. Wanting to know more about this history, we turn to Leonard Zeskin, author of the 2005 book Blood and Politics, White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream. The book and Leonard have long been viewed as one of the foremost authorities on the history of white nationalism and the far right in general. At a time when the murders of Atomwaffen and swastikas etched into the clips of high school shooters grab headlines, it is important that we look at the history and the ideas that have shaped these movements, as well as come to understand that without a material autonomous force that can build relationships with people on the ground and better the lives of poor and working class people while pushing towards a revolutionary horizon, the possibility for a revolutionary right may be just around the corner. Thanks for listening. All right, we're joined here today with Leonard Zeskin, author of the book that we're always talking about, Blood and Politics, White Nationalisms from the Margins to the Mainstream. Leonard, do you want to introduce yourself real quick?
I'm Leonard Zeskin. I live in Kansas City, and I'm one of the founders of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, where I now do most of my work. I worked for 9 years for Reverend C.T. Vivian at the Center for Democratic Renewal, formerly the National Anti-Klan Network. I've attended more than my fair share of Klan rallies, posse comitatus events, Christian Patriot doodahs, militias, Aryan things of all sorts, and read every damn thing those people published for years and years. So I'm not like a one-timer. I'm not a journalist primarily, although I've written plenty of things.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that Blood and Politics is so good is because it looks at, you know, a lot of things. It looks at how these movements intersect. You really break down, white nationalism between, you know, the vanguardists and people that want to enter the mainstream into the Republican Party or the political parties, and also the scope and depth of these movements. And this is really going to come out in the questions that we're going to go over. But just to kind of kick things off, excuse me, a lot of liberal and a lot of journalists have often portrayed white nationalism or far-right movements as largely made up of simply low-class or uneducated people. But in Blood and Politics, you show that at times the movement has existed as a network of cadres, Christian identity Bible camps, radio stations, even things that look like communes, paramilitary training centers, and so on. Also, as you point out in the book, the scope of the influence, for instance, in the farm movement, the farmer movement with groups like Posse Comitatus or the National Alliance come to mind. Why is it important to realize that at times insurrectionary and potentially even revolutionary nature of the far right and not dismiss it?
Well, there's three questions actually that you've posed in that. First of all, I tried to point out that the white nationalist movement time and again represents a cross-section of white people in the United States. There's a few, very few millionaires, but there are a few. There's a lot of doctors and lawyers and chiropractors and professors. And there's regular folks and salesmen of various sorts and a lot of working class people as the main body of white Americans, Americans, period, is. So it looks like white America. I think it's important to understand its revolutionary character because that's the period we're in. White nationalism is in this period aimed at tearing the United States apart and creating a whites-only nation state. And the book, I describe how the white supremacist movement of the 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s became the white nationalist movement at a moment when ethnic and racial nationalism was surging across the world as the Soviet bloc broke apart. So it's connected to the worldwide movement, and it's a revolutionary phenomenon. To talk about it in any other way is just not to describe it correctly.
In Blood and Politics, you talk about how many of the neo-Nazi and KKK groups became involved in the political campaigns of people like Barry Goldwater and George Wallace. In the case with Wallace, this helped to launch the careers of people like William Pierce and also William Carteret. And in many ways, this bears resemblance to today with Trump. Can you summarize for listeners why these campaigns were important for the far right and how they helped to build up the various neo-Nazi, KKK, and other far right groups?
Well, let me take this opportunity to describe to you how I label various organizations. One is the term neo-Nazi I reserve for those who openly imitate Hitler's Nazis. They wear swastika armbands. And they, of course, have Hitler's ideology. The National Alliance is a national socialist organization. That is, has Hitler's ideology, but he eschewed the armbands even when he was in the National Socialist White People's Party. He thought dressing up like a Nazi was a Hollywood escape, and it wasn't serious. So I think understanding the difference between neo-Nazi and national socialist organizations, and most today are national socialist. I think that understanding why they get involved in the electoral operations of Barry Goldwater and George Wallace is because Barry Goldwater and George Wallace at the time was interested in the same thing they were, which was preserving Jim Crow segregation. That's what the demand of the 50s and 60s was. And they were, in a certain sense, conservative. They were not revolutionary, even when they got as violent as the Mississippi Klan did and so forth. They were aimed at conservative goals. Today, they're revolutionary, and they're aiming to overthrow the whole thing. When they get involved in organizations like Trump or supporting Trump, it's for tactical political reasons. And I think we have to stop it as best we can. But one of the things we have to understand is the difference between the strategic alliance of the Wallace and the Klan in 1968 and the tactical alliance between groups like David Duke and Trump. Trump's got no use for David Duke. Wallace had use for the Klan.
Right, and it's interesting when Trump, just as an aside, when Trump tried to say that he had no idea who David Duke was, I remember when that came out, I remember in your book, you talk about how Trump at one point joined the Reform Party and actually left because he said of people like David Duke and Pat Buchanan.
Taking Donald Trump too seriously is a disease that infects the liberal mind.
Right, right, right. Well, just moving on here. In a chapter in Blood and Politics about the incident at Ruby Ridge, along with the free speech trials that Metzger and other leaders were involved in, the rebranding of the white power, white nationalist movement included gravitating towards the idea of white separatism or white nationalism. Can you talk about why this rebranding itself was important and how it played out during various court cases and through the mass media?
Well, one of the things is there's two separate items here. One of the things that the white supremacists and white nationalists have been trying to do since the 1970s is take the fire out of the way people call them. So David Duke has been running around telling people since he ran as a Republican in the Louisiana races of 1990 and 91 that he was a white civil rights activist, as if such a thing existed. And that's just an attempt to slur over what they actually believe. But the transformation of the movement from, Aryan Nations in 1983 used to say, our race is our nation. So they were racial nationalists, but it didn't become important until the Yugoslav civil wars, where they were fighting over who was an Orthodox Christian, who was a Catholic, and who was a Muslim. I mean, that's the only differences that existed inside of Yugoslavia. They all spoke basically the same language. They lived next to each other. They buried each other's dead. And nationalism came in, ethnic nationalism came in and tore the place up and killed people. And that's what these guys are aiming at today. They want to tear this place up. And I don't think you can mention it too many times.
Can you discuss how people like Louis Beam, for instance, and other white nationalists attempt to intervene in the Waco tragedy to their own advantage? How did the white power movement seize specifically on the Waco massacre?
Well, Ruby Ridge, that involved the Weaver family. The Weaver family were Christian identity believers, and Randy Weaver had been to Aryan Nations a couple of times. They were part of the movement. They weren't at the center of it like they became, but they were part of the movement. The Branch Davidians in Texas at Waco, they weren't racist at all. They had black people living there. They were nutty as hell. And they had a convoluted theology that placed the man that called himself David Koresh at the center of the universe. But the issues in Randy Weaver and Waco were the same issues, guns and religions. That's what Louis Beam saw. That's what he understood was going on, guns and religion. And he went down to Waco. He took it. The opportunity, if you will, to intervene and build support for the Waco stuff. And that was happening all over. Liberty Lobby was doing a lot of it, and it was across the board. People saw this, and this changed the nature of the white nationalist movement at that, because it shifted, if you will, off the a black person on the street and shifted everybody's eyes to the federal government. Some people took that to mean, well, they're not racist anymore. They're just interested in attacking the federal government. No, it was a clever move by long-term racists and bigots, white supremacists, to look at Waco and find a hole and find a way to build a following.
Right. And just for those that are not aware of who we're talking about when we mentioned Louis Beam was someone that was involved in the Ku Klux Klan, wrote a series of publications and edited various newsletters, but moreover, promoted this idea of, quote, leaderless resistance, that different cells should go out and engage in acts of essentially terrorism.
And he became an officer in the Aryan Nations for a little while. He went where the action was.
Right. Well, moving forward, in your eyes, what are the class dynamics that have played out in the white power movement? What are some of the reoccurring realities between those that lead and those who are led?
Well, there is a cross-class character to some of the organizations over the years. The National Alliance was the one organization that people of all classes were in. Working class Bob Matthews, who worked, you know, on the land and picking fruit and worked by the hand. And William Pierce, who was a physics professor. So it was an organization where they all were. But the general tendency was that groups and that individuals would go to organizations that represented their class positions. So the Klan in the 70s and 80s, when it was strong in Georgia and North Carolina with the White Patriot Party and the Invisible Empire in Alabama and David Duke's Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, they became strong primarily among working class people. Now, I'm not one of those who thinks that these working class people were stupid. They were not. They understood what they were doing. Some of them were very articulate. And the class dynamics between them and the lawyers, they would tag along with the lawyers, but they kept to themselves and they kept to their working class organizations. And what it means for us is we've got to stop thinking about these people in these movements as stupid, uneducated, ignorant, working class people. The working class is actually fairly smart. When I worked at the United Auto Workers in a Chevy plant, they read the Wall Street Journal every morning when they came into work. They played chess and checkers on lunch. They were as intelligent as any group of people. And they understood what was happening in the world. And working class people are prepared to rule it if they'll get smart about it. But they're not smart when they're in white power groups. But they know what they're doing.
You know, there's a section in the book where you start to talk about the Christian far right, people like Pat Robertson, for instance. Historically, what has the interplay been between the Christian far right and the white power movement?
The white power movement generally hated Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson was his own kind of Dundick. And, you know, he was a racist for a number of years. And he was part of the, stop the desegregation of the South phenomenon. But they didn't like Pat Robertson because they thought he was a Zionist. In other words, he didn't want to kill all the Jews. And the white power group simply supplanted a lot of the Christian right. And the second thing they did is by moving the Christian right on theological issues, which is where the Christian identity stuff came in, they pushed the Christian identity groups, pushed the Christian right to adopt a different kind of end times theology, an end times theology in which you just don't wait for it to happen to you, but you got to fight. And that's the dominant attitude today, actually.
You know, one thing we do want to encourage people, if you do have, excuse me, access to Netflix, is that you yourself are featured in a new Netflix documentary about the Oklahoma City bombing and Timothy McVeigh, which personally I have watched. I highly recommend to people. And we encourage people to watch it because you very firmly place Timothy McVeigh within the white nationalist camp. Can you talk about the network of communal, you know, quote, intentional communities that were arming and training people for a future race war or even just
survivalist camps?
Sure.
They weren't intentional communities. You build intentional communities. They build survivalist camps.
Well, I mean, it's very intentional. But, a place like Elohim City comes to mind, for instance, that McVeigh visited. You know, just looking at these things either, you know, as they were in the period that McVeigh was around in the 90s or before, what was the size and scope of these communities and what did they do? And also, do they still exist now?
Well, there was in the 80s, in the beginning of the 80s, in the 70s, the Covenant Sword and the Arm of the Lord camp in southern Missouri. And they were actually bigger than a lot of the other camps. They had about 300 people there under the sway of James L. Ellison. And a lot of them became involved in the group called The Order, which was an underground guerrilla operation. And then the FBI squashed the whole thing in 85. But Elohim City, I visited Elohim City, And they were very proud of the kind of houses that they built. They built these kind of crazy foam, hard foam domes. And they had cattle, and they operated like a group intentional community with educating their kids and so forth. And the population would ebb and flow a little bit. They had their own involvement in the trucking industry. A number of the brothers of the founder of, I mean, sons of the founder became involved in driving over the road trucks. And so they were involved in the ordinary economics around them, whereas the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord withdrew from the economy of the world and they collected welfare. So at the Elohim camp, I think it still exists today. It's kind of quiet. They have a Christian identity belief, but they keep it on the down low. And they became a camp for all sorts of people to visit. There's not as many of these camps as there was. Christian identity is not as important today as it was in the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, it was a glue that bound large sections of the movement together. But today, there's a lot of pagans, followers of Thor, scientific racists, and so forth. And so Christian identity isn't as important as it used to be.
You know, post-Ruby Ridge, in the book, you discuss how the modern militia movement grew out of meetings that brought together both the Aryan nations and various far-right groups that were more connected with, guns and stuff like that. Can you talk about this history? The modern militia movement often attempts to portray itself in today's world as not associated in any way whatsoever with neo-Nazis or white nationalists. But what's the real history?
Well, the real history is that there were people who disagreed with me when I said in those days, in the mid-90s, that the white militias, which are private armies, were racist, were white supremacists. Well, they grew directly out of the ideology of a sense of citizenship that wanted to ignore the 14th Amendment. They had a core white supremacist playbook that they all worked from that made them all white supremacists. They played from that white supremacist. Today, the militia movement, a lot of them, the threepers, so-called threepers, have a lot of them come out of the Tea Party movement. And they're not the same. Now, I think they're white supremacists. I believe that they're aiming at maintaining and defending the privileges and prerogatives of white people as a majority status. But they're not the same as the white nationalists in the mid-90s who wanted to just tear the place up.
I mean, I encourage people, obviously, to read the book. But, I mean, I just want people to appreciate, like, in the book you lay out how, you know, big some of these movements were. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Bible study camps for Christian identity, you know, these kind of armed paramilitary training centers. I mean, there was a very large sea for these groups to swim in. I mean, they had radio stations, newsletters.
That's absolutely the case. And there's a large sea today of believers in the militia world. So,
Well, going back to the book, you know, it ends in 2005, more or less. And while that misses the kind of reactionary wave to the immigrant rights movement that exploded in 2006, it pretty much leaves off at a time when neo-Nazis and white power groups were kind of at a point of extreme disarray. I mean, lots of the groups that were discussed in the book kind of fell apart. People went to prison. Some people died. So how do we go from there? So how did we go from kind of that moment to where we are now with the so-called alt-right?
Well, I think two things happened. One is we cannot dismiss the importance of the Tea Party movement during the Obama years for carrying the germ, the bacillus of white, the sense of white dispossession. The Tea Party movement was about white people who wanted their country back. Remember, they said that all the time. We want our nation back. And the Tea Party movement was important as a bridge. Then the second thing that happened is a generational change. It went from the 70-year-olds, Willis Cartow, and 80-year-olds, 70 and 80-year-olds like Cartow and William Pierce, to a new generation of 30 and 40-year-olds who have taken over the movement today. And I think that was most explicit in Charlottesville. Charlottesville was a nexus point where you saw the change, the generational change inside the movement. David Duke was there. He played no role. He played no leadership role. When David Duke went to the Forsyth County rallies in 1987, he popped out of there out of nowhere and became a big leader again. Well, he didn't become a leader again out of the Charlottesville. It was other people that did. And they're giving us a problem now.
You know, just as kind of aside, this isn't in our questions, but I mean, just for somebody like yourself that's spent so long studying these groups, I mean, when you think about Charlottesville and Unite the Right, this something that just like kind of took you by surprise, or was this something that was just like,
no, it was coming. It was coming.
Yeah,
it was coming. The battle over Confederate monuments has been long, and you'll know, you know, and I discuss it in Blood and Politics. The battle over Confederate monuments has long been a battle over white identity. And certainly the white supremacists, the white nationalists, understood it that way. The rally at Charlottesville where Heather Heyer was murdered was the third rally that summer. It was already on the map when that occurred. They had been building for it. So didn't take me by surprise. And it's ugly. Mm-hmm. Stone to the bone ugly.
Yeah. Well, we're going to kind of go back into the book and talk about connections with mainstream politics. But in the book, you spend a lot of time talking about the connections between outright white nationalists and those in mainstream politics, particularly the Republican Party, but also some third parties. Pat Buchanan, for instance, stating, this is a great part of the book, but stating as an aside to somebody that he reads the Liberty Lobby publication, for instance. Can you talk broadly about the historic interplay between the far right and established political parties?
Well, what happened was with Pat Buchanan is David Duke came along in 90 and 91, and he won a majority of the white vote in Louisiana for a statewide office. He lost because black people went to the polls. If the black folks hadn't gone to the polls, they saved white people's asses. Otherwise, white people would have elected a national socialist, a Nazi. And David Duke wanted power. He was tired of being on the margins. He wanted to get into the mix and assert his dominance. And to a certain extent, he did during those years. And then Pat Buchanan came along and said, what we need now is David Duke without the sheets. And that's what Pat Buchanan did. And the interplay was for white nationalists and white supremacists. It was a place, electoral politics became a place that they could find people who believed like they did. Burnish their name so that they were not as easily attacked, and step up in the world, if you will. Not so different than the Socialist Worker Party running candidates all the time. They just do it so that they can get their name in the public. That's what the was going on in there. Now, what happened is in that same period, there was a shift among mainstream political people. like Buchanan, like Sam Francis, who moved away from the staid conservatism of, say, Heritage Foundation or something a little bit worse, and they moved into the white nationalist camp. And that doubled their, you know, that doubled the success of what they were doing. And it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference because it gives the movement a bigger platform to stand on.
Well, looking kind of towards today, in today's world, we have seen the campaigns of people like Trump, Roy Moore, and now this guy, Paul Neelan. And also, I don't know if you're aware, or I'm sure you're aware, there's this somebody that's a former part of the American Nazi Party that's running unopposed somewhere.
Jones.
Right.
He runs here, Christ. He should just go home. He's a retired insurance man. Mm-hmm. He's a joke in Illinois.
But I just wanted to get your take. You know, is history repeating itself today, or are we seeing something completely different in this, you know?
I think we're seeing something different because white nationalism has broached thoroughly into the mainstream. In the years previous, it was trying to get in the mainstream. Now it's mainstream. We've got a different battle on our hands. More battle on our hands than just what we had in the past. It requires to know what's going on and be smarter about it. And I'm afraid that our side of the street isn't as smart as it thinks it is.
The next question I feel like is one of the most important questions we're going to talk about. But you did a really great interview with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and in it you talk about in the late 1970s a real consciousness began to emerge that whites were in a dispossessed majority. And nowadays, with the so-called alt-right, they often talk about how changes in immigration laws in the mid-1960s, which allowed non-whites to enter the U.S., was a tipping point in so-called white genocide. And I'm just curious if you can talk historically about how those in the white power movement have attempted to portray themselves as victims, or kind of like really pushed this narrative of white victimization. I feel this is really key, because if you look at somebody like Tucker Carlson on Fox, I mean, that's really kind of like what they're selling. And I'm just curious if you can add your thoughts.
Well, I think the concept that white people are being oppressed is actually very dangerous, in part because it's shared by so many white people. A majority of white people in the United States today, according to polls that I've been looking at, now think that they're oppressed, and they're oppressed by black people. It's crazy. It's upside down, but it's very dangerous. The notion that they were oppressed started really after the publication of a book called Dispossessed Majority in 1972 by a man named, whose pseudonym named Wilmot Robertson. That's the tune that they've been playing ever since. It's part of their revolutionary notion that's why they've got to overthrow the government, because the government's now in somebody else's hands. And understanding that is central to understanding what's the difference today between this movement and the movement of the Klans and the White Citizens Councils in the 50s and 60s. They were defenders of the status quo. As I said earlier, the ones today want to overthrow it because they see themselves as oppressed by it.
You said in an interview with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which we already talked about, you said, quote, "Here's the trick about spotting the transformation into a white revolutionary movement. The piece that makes them the most revolutionary is anti-Semitism, because it creates for them a ruling class. The invention of a fake ruling class transformed a reform-oriented conservative movement into a revolutionary movement," end quote. Can you just explain that to people? Like, why is this component?
Well, David Duke needed to explain to people that he was going to try and recruit why white people were oppressed. He says in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, we had a battle over civil rights and black freedom in the country, and we lost that fight. Now, why did we lose that fight? He asked. We lost that fight because the Jews were running the show, not black people. They're too stupid, he would say. And so he would say the Jews are running the show. And the Jews became, like I say, a false ruling class. They're not the real ruling class. God, we should understand that. And all of them have developed off of that idea. Now, Willis Carteau, who developed his ideas in the 50s and 60s and also had was the grandfather, if you will, of Holocaust denial in this country. He saw knocking down the Jews as a road to power for him, sort of like a Hitlerite. So the Jews became a battering ram. Now, I've had arguments with my friends over the years, and some of them say, well, they don't have to be anti-Semites. Well, they don't. They could just support white supremacy. And there are groups in this movement like American Renaissance that have not developed full-blown whites, notions of Jewish conspiracy and control. American Renaissance even had Jews at some of their meetings, God forbid. But they did. But for the main, having the Jews as the fake ruling class gave them more a place to stand. And that they've stood on that one for a long time.
Yeah, I just think that's a really important thing to point out.
You don't have to like Israel, you don't have to like Zionists, but you have to understand. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that they're picking on Jews not because they really hate Jews, although some of them do. Mm-hmm. They're doing it for strictly ideological purposes, and they'll kill all the Jews they can get their hands on if they have power, mm-hmm, for strictly ideological purposes.
Right. Well, in the same interview, you went on to say, quote, I think the future depends on whether or not the economic crisis that we're in becomes a political crisis, a crisis in confidence in the government. It's at the same point that the white nationalists will have their greatest chance, end quote. Do you still find this to be true? This interview we're talking about was...
Well, I don't know if it's the greatest chance that they'll have. And not everybody loves Trump. Uh-huh. There's a lot of people that don't like them. And there is confidence in the government. And the white nationalists are doing quite fine, thank you. And we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. You just want to explain that a little more? How are we in trouble, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we're not responding to them. We're not responding to them in a way that shuts them down. Mm-hmm. We want to shut them down. We act like, we run all over the place and call them names and scream at them when they show up and so forth. But that's not shutting them down. And we've got to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in closing, you've seen the rise and fall of the far right over the decades. You've written this book, and it's very big. What advice would you give
to... It took me a while to get it all out.
Right. I mean, what advice would you give to communities and groups organizing against the far right in today's world?
You're a historical actor. That's what you are. You're an historical agent when you're trying to organize. And if you're an historical agent, you should learn your history. Two, I think that we need to understand that as we act in history, we become historical agents. Mm-hmm. And as historical agents, we should know our history. And we should know it better than the other side. Two, we should understand the nature of our opposition. We should not rely on old facts. We should get new facts and compare them to the old facts. We should understand everything about what we're doing. And three, I think we need to think twice about what we're doing, because right now we're not winning, and we need to beat these guys, because the fate of people of all colors and everybody on this country and actually around the world, because there's a fight around the world going on right now, and we've got to get smarter and beat them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leonard, is there any other thing you want to throw out there? Any resources that people can kind of check out your work or follow what you are working on?
Yeah, www.irehr.org.
Mm-hmm.
www.irehr.org. My archive of stuff that I wrote for the Forward or the American Prospect or whatever is at www.leonardzeskin.com.
Right. And as always, we encourage people to read the book, Blood and Politics, White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream.
If you want the book, contact me at irehr.org.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for talking with us about this, you know, really important and often depressing subject, but it's great to have somebody that's so astute in the history of these movements to give us their insight, and thank you for coming on the program. It's a road called coast to coast, sea to shining sea. Up, north, down, south, east coast, midwest. Whole west, worldwide. Especially you pull that shit on this side, you get your ass knocked the fuck out again like Devo on Friday, motherfucker. That's exactly where the fuck y'all wanna take it. You think some motherfucking torches got us scared? If that's where you wanna take it, you'll get exactly what the fuck you signed for. Fuck a Nazi, fuck a fascist. All hands on deck, stand up, let's get it. Skinheads ain't about shit. Skinheads ain't about shit. Nah. Fuck supremacists. Fuck supremacists. Crackers trying to get some clout quick. Run they mouth slick. Pull up to your hood, I doubt it. Get surrounded. Yeah. Right to the side of the damn lot. Ain't finna be another Auschwitz. Hunt around, jump on my damn side. Go sell that on the mountain. Think about your blood. Think about your kids. When it get lit, will you be equipped? Who finna die? Fist us versus them. Get you a stick. Don't let it hit. Might be the man in your delegates. Ay. Might damn well be the president. Ay. Might be your next door neighbors. What? Hashtag that ass for the paper. Nah. If your mans and them get upset. What? Wanna object, that's suspect. What? When it comes down to the get down. What? When I stand up for the unrest. Look, I get no fuck what you look like. Let's link up, cause this still our nation. They ain't finna take it. We got no patience for Aryan hatred. If God what they playing, send them to Satan. And ain't no telling where they finna take it. We need the peace, but we don't need to wait. If you think I'm finna die on my knees, I gotta squeeze. Ain't no debate.
Fuck the alright, motherfucker. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Hit them Nazi bucks with the buck, lead they ass slug. Hit them Nazi bucks with the buck, lead they ass slug. Hit them Nazi bucks with the buck, lead they ass slug. Hit them Nazi bucks with the buck, lead they ass slug.